Chapter 2. Be informed, get adjusted.
Education has the power to ease the transition in the months after your diagnosis, but obtaining the facts you need isn't always easy. In this chapter, you'll find out how to inform yourself by working with your healthcare providers, through your own research, and through support groups. Armed with knowledge, you'll be able to take control of your health and your future.
I am amazed at how often people with chronic illness get a diagnosis and little else. On countless occasions, I have asked fellow patients simple questions about their conditions only to discover they don't understand the basics. They haven't been given or haven't sought out the information. In the first months after diagnosis, information is your most powerful ally. The more you educate yourself, the more likely you'll choose the right doctor, make good decisions about your health care, gain confidence, and feel less out of control. Of course, getting the information you need isn't always easy. First, you'll have to learn the language of your illness. This entails understanding the hailstorm of technical medical terms, medications, and treatments headed your way.
The beginning of wisdom is to call things by the right names. Chinese proverb.
Working inside the system. Team with your doctors. Becoming educated about your illness is something you must want to do. No one will force the information on you. Instead, your doctor might simply rattle on using terms you don't understand. If you don't tell her to slow down and ask her some questions, you will miss the opportunity to become actively involved in your own care. Many times I have positively influenced the course of my treatment because I did my homework and found the right issues to probe. Translating medicalese. The first step in information gathering is unraveling your physician's medicalese. Medical jargon is difficult for the uninitiated to sort through, so don't feel bad if it takes you a while to catch on. As proof, here's a humorous anecdote that's made rounds through the medical community. A patient checked into the emergency room complaining of difficulty breathing. The doctor examined him and wrote down a few notes on the patient's chart. When the doctor left the room, the patient reviewed the notes. He became flushed with anger. When the doctor returned, he snapped, "Why'd you describe me as a son of a bitch?" The physician patiently explained, "SOB is shorthand for shortness of breath." Physicians use hundreds of acronyms to describe symptoms, tests, medications, and treatments. These acronyms, coupled with the fact that doctors are justifiably stereotyped for bad penmanship, are a breeding ground for confusion. Never take the quick notes in your chart personally, and always ask if you don't understand something a medical provider has written or said. Once you've learned the basics of your illness and the 8 million new words that go along with it, you'll find it easier to navigate your care. Here are some ways to work through medical ease. Ask questions. By the end of this chapter, these words will ring in your ears like a mantra. Ask questions, ask questions, ask questions. Inquiring about things you don't understand is the best way to figure them out. Take notes at doctor visits. This is critical, especially in the rushed environment of the physician's office. Don't be afraid to ask your doctor for spellings of unfamiliar words. He will appreciate your desire to get informed and the resulting thoughtful questions. Take someone with you to the visit. Especially right after your diagnosis, it can be difficult to concentrate on, let alone absorb, what your doctor is saying, so note-taking may be impossible. Take someone you love and trust, and ask that person to pay attention for you. Of course, it is also critical to have that person there to lend support and understanding. Later, you can sit down together and go through the notes at your own pace. This way, you will be sure you didn't miss or misinterpret anything. Research. In the more relaxed environment of your home or library, take out the notes from your visit and unearth as much information as you can. Use the terms as keywords for internet searches. At the library, ask for help on finding the latest articles on your condition. If you feel too sick, ask your partner or friend to copy off or print out some articles for you. In the beginning, expect to feel overwhelmed and confused, but stick with it. The language will grow familiar, and before long, you too will be fluent in medicalese. Take notes again. Take notes while you are researching. Keep a special sheet reserved for questions that crop up as you siphon through the information. At your next doctor visit, pull out your questions and fire away. The doctor said what? Following is even more evidence that you can't always take what the doctor writes in your chart personally. These physicians' comments were compiled from actual medical transcriptions and are featured in Richard Lederer's 1996 book, Fractured English. She has no rigors or shaking chills, but her husband states that she was very hot in bed last night. He was eating his tray, so I didn't examine him. The patient is a Catholic nun currently in between missionaries. For his impotence, we will discontinue the meds and let his wife handle him. The patient was bitten by a bat as he walked down the street on his thumb. Patient's wife hit him over the head with an ironing board, which now has 6 stitches in it. This 54-year-old female is complaining of abdominal cramps with BMs on the one hand and constipation on the other. Healthy-appearing, decrepit, 69-year-old white female, mentally alert, but forgetful. When she fainted, her eyes rolled around the room. He states he hit his head on his forehead. She is to refrain from sexual intercourse until I see her in the office. Patient stated that if she would lie down, within 2 or 3 minutes, something would come across her abdomen and knock her up. Patient has chest pains if she lies on her left side for over a year. Finding Dr. Wright. As if it's not hard enough to muck through the difficult new terminology, you will likely be faced with another challenge during the post-diagnosis stage, finding a new doctor. The physician who made your initial diagnosis will often advise you to go to a specialist for continuing care, or you may be dissatisfied with your doctor's assessment and desire a second opinion. As a result, you'll probably meet with several practitioners in the coming months. Finding the right one is critical. When you have a chronic illness, the relationship with your doctor is like a marriage. Together, you will be tackling some of the most difficult decisions of your life. You must select your physician with almost the same care you pick your spouse. If your doctor is not marriage material, keep on searching. Once you find the one, chances are greater that you'll live chronically happy ever after. I've had my share of physicians. I spent most of my younger years at university hospitals where it seemed I had a new doctor every month. Some were sensitive, creative professionals, while others were arrogant, "I'm the boss, my time is too valuable to answer your questions" types, who seemed to dictate care plans rather than involve me in the process. I learned a lot from those experiences. Mainly, I discovered I have the right to choose who cares for me, rather than accept whoever happens to be on shift that day. I also discovered what kind of doctor I like. One who understands the difficulties I'm going through, listens to my side of the story, and involves me in decisions. Good doctors focus on what's right with their patients. I could write a long list of what's wrong with me, and if I focused on that all the time, I'd never get out of bed in the morning. So I think a good doctor is, in a sense, a spin doctor. She gives hope, while at the same time, she's straight about the future. Hang in there until you find a match. Thinking about the ideal doctor is different from actually finding one. When we feel sick, the last thing we want to do is drag ourselves from doctor to doctor until we locate a match. Insurance plans are complicated and often restrict which specialists we can see. And because of the pre-authorization system of many HMOs, by the time we get permission to visit certain doctors, we feel so lucky we want to stop right there. This is kind of like accepting a less than perfect date after a long dry spell. He's better than nothing. At least someone wants to go out with me. Despite such difficulties, it is important that you exhaust all avenues to ensure you receive the very best care. If you aren't satisfied with your treatment, see every specialist your insurance allows until you find someone who works for you. A good idea is to ask your fellow patients about their practitioners. If someone you trust raves about her physician, find out if she's available under your insurance plan. It might also be worth researching the best in your area, despite insurance restrictions. You could potentially go out of plan and fight for care by this doctor or opt to pay out of pocket. I have found that you can sometimes work with your insurance company to pay a portion of the cost. This approach is easier to manage if you negotiate with your insurance company before going to the doctor. Forking out cash is tough, but this is the harsh reality of living with a chronic illness. And isn't your health worth it? In the United States, we have the finest healthcare in the world despite its pitfalls. Take advantage of this fact. You have a right to seek out the very best. The questions to ask. Now that you've found the right doctor, it's important to get the most out of your visits by asking pointed questions. Too often, if you don't ask, they won't tell. Going to the doctor requires gleaning a lot of information in a short amount of time, often in a hurried environment. I suggest you write out your questions and prioritize them. By getting prepared, you can rapid-fire your inquiries during the visit and you'll be able to take good notes, comfortable you aren't forgetting anything. A quick note. Be sure you save the right questions for the right healthcare provider. If your particular illness requires a special type of diet, for instance, instead of asking your transplant surgeon how to best prepare the food, check in with your specialist, the nutritionist, or dietitian. During the office visit, be sure to ask the following. What's your number? Sometimes I forget to ask the simplest questions, but if an emergency comes up, these answers can be the most important. Ask your doctor the best way to contact her if you have questions between visits, by phone, email, or fax. Write down her contact information. Find out if she has an assistant or partner who is more readily available. Ask who to call if you need a refill of a prescription and make sure to get a number as well as a name. What's next? I like to be optimistic, but I'm a realist too. I feel better knowing what my options are if the current plan of treatment doesn't work. This tactic gives me the time to read up on alternatives. A few examples of questions might be, when should I expect a change in my symptoms due to the treatment plan? Will the changes happen gradually or suddenly? What happens if my condition gets worse? If I get better, how long will the treatment plan last? Are there any other therapies available if this one doesn't work? What's an emergency? When living with a chronic illness, feeling sick is a way of life, so sometimes it's hard to trust our body's signals. When we're always in pain, at what point is it a warning that we are in an emergency situation? Getting specific guidelines helps. For instance, if you struggle with high blood pressure, ask what blood pressure warrants a trip to the emergency room. Ask when a fever is cause for alarm. If you're going into surgery, find out the signs of infection. If you have a catheter, learn what to do if it leaks. By getting specific responses to questions like these, you can plan ahead a little and ease your mind. Will you take good care of me? If you were visiting the doctor prior to a new procedure or surgery, now's the time to get those last queries answered and to let the staff know what you need. Often the visit before a new course of treatment can be frightening. I find I'm comforted by asking questions like these. How long have you been doing this? Is there another patient I can speak to who has had the procedure? It would be very helpful if someone would hold my hand during the procedure. Would that be possible? Will I feel any pain? Will you tell me what is going on during the procedure? Are there blankets available if I become cold? Will you tell my family how I'm doing? Such questions accomplish two things. First, they make you feel you are a true partner in your care. Next, they let your health team know how they can best help you. In my experience, too often we expect our care providers to read our minds. Also, don't ask these questions just before the procedure. Give your healthcare professionals time to respond to your requests. Is there anything I need to know about my meds? When you take medications, there can often be side effects. Ask your doctor if there is anything you should be on the lookout for. Find out when to take the medication and whether to take it on a full or empty stomach. Be sure to ask if the medication will make you drowsy. When you pick up your meds, the pharmacist is also knowledgeable about medications and side effects. The National Library of Medicine's Medline Plus at www.nlm.nih.gov/medlineplus is a great site to search for medication side effects. Also remember, alcohol and medications don't always mix. Be aware of this and read the label before taking. Useful tip? If you're on several meds at once, as most of us are, dosage schedules and amounts are easy to get mixed up. To eliminate uncertainty when discussing your medications, prepare a list of meds you're taking prior to the visit. Or better yet, put them in a bag and take them with you. How bad or good is it, really? I have found if I set my sight on the right expectations, I do not get upset. The more upfront a doctor is about the possible outcomes of a treatment, the more realistic my expectations will be. This process wasn't always easy for me. Aligning my hopes with the truth was a skill I had to learn. When I was younger and on dialysis, despite what the specialist said, I thought all my problems would be solved once my name came up on the transplant list. "Once I'm off dialysis, I'll really live," I'd think. I avoided the very real possibility that even if I underwent the surgery, the kidney could reject. After my second failed transplant, I realized I needed to reframe my expectations. There was no magic elixir that would just take the illness away. It was high time I started living for today, even if that meant being on dialysis. Good physicians will push you to face reality when you don't necessarily want to know how bad something is. As another example, for many years, my doctors suspected my bone density was low, and they continually pushed me to take the test. I put it off and joked, "Thank God I'm not even 5 feet tall. If I fall, there's no way I'll break any bones when I'm this close to the ground." At their prodding, I finally had the test, and my bone density is indeed low, mainly from years of dialysis and the daily steroids. With their help, I've come out of denial, and I've researched the many treatments and exercises available. Now I realize I have lots of options to improve the condition. Can I get a pamphlet on that? In most cases, by simply asking your healthcare professional for printed material, you can receive ample information to begin the process of educating yourself. If you don't like what you hear, get a second opinion. As you ask your questions and listen to the doctor's answers, remember you are never stuck with any one doctor's assessment of your situation. Like all of us, doctors make mistakes, or they draw different opinions based on the facts in front of them. You won't hurt her feelings. Well, you might, but if you do, then she's not the one for you. Getting a second opinion can help confirm a diagnosis, or it can give you some wiggle room to pursue a new avenue of treatment. A second opinion can also lift your spirits, as it did my friend Melissa's. Her doctor projected that she had 2 years before she would likely reject her kidney, which she received 15 years ago. Melissa is a case manager for a healthcare company, so she's used to navigating the difficult waters of the medical field, but it seemed she had forgotten how to advocate for herself. She was resigned and depressed and hadn't even considered getting a second opinion from her transplant physician. I suggested to Melissa that she schedule an appointment. "You never know, he may have some new scoop on how to prevent chronic rejection," I said. Melissa may end up hearing the same prognosis from the transplant team, but after she made the appointment, she said she still felt better. She was taking back control and gained a sense of accomplishment because she knew she was pursuing all her resources. Second opinions can also help you avoid the worst-case scenario. Finding out after the fact that there was something you could have done to remedy the problem. Thank goodness Richard Daggett sought a second opinion. Diagnosed with polio at age 13, Daggett has spent his life monitoring the debilitating after effects of his disease. Several years ago, Daggett visited his physician for a cold. The doctor did some superficial tests and said, "You're fatigued, go home and get some rest," Daggett recalls. "But I knew enough about polio and respiratory inhibition that I knew something wasn't right. I knew the residuals of polio left me with weakened lungs. I decided to call a pulmonary specialist. When I described my symptoms, they said, 'Come in as soon as you can.' It turns out I was suffering from pulmonary failure. I was admitted to the hospital. If I'd taken the advice of my family physician, I probably would have died." Trust your instincts, or save the rooster combs. Though we wish they did, doctors don't always know best. I'll never forget the time I landed in the emergency room after my knee conked out. My specialist recommended I go to the emergency room to get a test done so she could see if I'd torn my meniscus disc. This bout of trouble came on the heels of 5 weeks of drug therapy involving an expensive new med made of, believe it or not, rooster combs. After the usual excruciating wait in the emergency room, the doctor finally saw me. I was in a tremendous amount of pain. I resisted my first instinct, which was to ask for a pain injection just to get out of my misery. After a quick examination, the doctor made the obvious observation that my knee was swollen. Without telling me her plans, she instructed the nurse to prepare a table where she could drain the excess fluid. Once I realized what was happening, I explained to the nurse that the doctor should page my knee specialist to confer, since I didn't think she would approve of the procedure. And hey, I didn't want my expensive rooster combs going down the drain. The doctor wasn't too happy with my assertiveness, but I explained to her as nicely as I could that I've survived my chronic illness because I take control of my medical care, even when I'm in severe pain or I may need to inconvenience someone. The doctor finally paged my specialist, who, as I suspected, recommended against removing the fluid. She instead suggested I get some crutches and hobble into her office the following morning. A big part of me, the part that was in pain, wanted the emergency room doctor to just make my knee better instantly. But my instincts told me that the best thing for my health, in the long term, would involve a longer and more painful process. As it turned out, my knee was back to normal in about 5 days. And the best part of all, I saved my expensive rooster combs. Like me, Shirley Jones, no relation to the celebrity, trusts her instincts when it comes to her medical care. She had kidney failure and sought a new doctor after hers repeatedly sidestepped her questions about transplantation. When I probed my doctor about being placed on a transplant list, he would casually change the subject, she remembers. The information, or lack of information, he was relaying was starting to take its toll on me emotionally. Doctors may know a lot about medicine, but they don't always know how to communicate the information you need. Rather than give in, Jones began researching her own condition. The search was fruitful and led her to much better care. I read as much information as I could get my hands on and found a support group of fellow patients. I managed to get my own appointment with the transplant team and was listed with no help of my previous doctor, she explains. I then found a doctor who was willing to participate in the day-to-day care of my transplant and be a true partner in my care. Today, I have a successful kidney pancreas transplant. Remember, when you have a chronic illness, your goal isn't to win a popularity contest with the medical staff. It's to get the best treatment available so you can live as healthy a life as possible. You are the customer. You are employing these people and paying them for their services. Trust your instincts, and you will get the best care.
Progress begins with the belief that what is necessary is possible. Norman Cousins.
Lori's Toolbox 2. A prescription for Dr. Wright. Write your own. A girl has a right to dream, right? Remember when you were younger and you and your friends would write down the qualities of the dream guy? 1. Tall. 2. Funny. 3. Cool dresser. 4. Romantic. You get the picture. Well, times have changed. Now it's more important to find the perfect doctor than the perfect 10. It may seem strange to revert to junior high tactics to find a physician, but writing down Dr. Wright's qualities might just help. For one, you'll discover a thing or two about your needs. Next, you can use the points to develop questions when interviewing the candidate later. Based on my criteria, for instance, I'd ask my prospective doctor if he's an expert in his specialty, and I'd confirm he wouldn't get agitated if I sought a second opinion. My dream doctor, 1, treats me as an individual and doesn't cookie-cut me into a plan that works for him. After all, I have to live with the plan 24 hours a day. If I am not in agreement, the treatment won't work. 2, is never threatened if I want to seek a second opinion. A second opinion does not question a doctor's intelligence. It simply gives patients confirmation that they are on the right track. 3. Speaks to me as an equal, not, I am the doctor, you are the patient, therefore I am the boss. 4. Looks me in the eye when he is speaking. 5. Employs a staff that is professional, organized, and pleasant. 6. Is an expert in his specialty. 7. Is reliable and on time. 8. Makes the effort to make me feel comfortable when examining me or talking about personal or embarrassing issues. 9. Understands that this is my 15 minutes to address my healthcare issues, so he doesn't take phone calls or have a hand on the doorknob while talking to me. 10. Validates, holds my hand, allows me to grieve when sharing bad news. 11. Provides me with the educational material, websites, or books to better understand my condition. 12. Can see me within a few weeks, not a few months of calling to make an appointment. Going solo, researching on your own. Stretching beyond the hospital community to research can be a vital part of your healing process. By keeping up with the latest studies, alternative treatments, and news about your illness, you'll find you can reclaim some control over your health. More than once, patients' own research has led to their involvement in cutting-edge research programs or successful use of alternative therapies. Also, researching can provide you with a meaningful and empowering project while your illness keeps you from other activities in your life. The Internet. A generation ago, independent research entailed heading to the library and conducting a painstaking search through hundreds of books, magazines, and newspaper articles, often yielding not enough information. Today, those of us with home computers can call up too much material in just a few seconds without leaving our homes. What people find on the internet can have a dramatic impact on their quality of care. Stephen Cattier was initially diagnosed with depression and anxiety, followed by a diagnosis of schizophrenia. When drugs for these ailments made his condition worse, Cattier began researching his symptoms on the internet, reaching out to faraway doctors and connecting with other patients. He eventually discovered he had a series of allergies to agents like wheat, cow's milk, eggs, and dust mites. His research helped him to avoid the allergens and work with his doctors to fine-tune his treatment. Katier continues to use the internet to seek out new doctors, health studies, and information. If you don't have access to the internet, your local library probably offers internet connections and free introductory classes. Check its schedule for information. The internet is not difficult to use, so you may not need a class. Just ask a librarian how to get started, and he or she will most likely be willing to help. Online support systems. For many people, the internet fulfills an even more important need than fact gathering: emotional support. It is filled with message boards and chat rooms dedicated to chronic illness. Most illness-specific sites also have community sections where people can share their stories, respond to other people's comments, give advice, and exchange resources and information. The benefits of an online support group are many. For one, you don't have to get out of your jammies to attend. The postings are anonymous, available around the clock, and you have the potential to meet people all over the world who share a common bond. Mandy Gordon, who suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome, found a friend through the internet who helped her cope with her loneliness. "We have met twice now, and it's been great. It takes some of the weight off," she explains. She has a similar problem, so she knows what it's like to not want to get out of bed.
Never trust a computer you can't throw out a window. Steve Wozniak.
The internet isn't always right. The internet isn't a panacea. In fact, it must be used with great caution. First and foremost, do not believe everything you read on the web. You will quickly discover there are a lot of people who post messages on boards or in chat rooms who are actually selling the latest snake oil. Some boards are monitored to limit these kinds of messages, but some unscrupulous emails manage to get posted. You'll also read amazing stories about people recovering from various ailments by using alternative medicines or methods. I would never discourage exploring all healthcare options, but such postings tend to get people's hopes up, and the results aren't always miraculous. Remember that anybody can put anything on the web. Also, be sure to guard your privacy carefully. Do you really know who is on the other end of that email address? There are many examples of internet crime and fraud, much of which is targeted to people who are not experienced web users. There are ways to make sure the information you read is credible. First, did the author cite his or her source material? Do the citations check out? Are the sources reliable? Does the author or webmaster list his or her contact information? Another way to protect yourself is to look for the blue and red HON code seal. The Health on the Net Foundation, or HON as it is widely known, created a code of ethics for medical web developers. Those sites that adhere to its guidelines carry the seal. It is self-regulatory, though, so this system isn't foolproof. To find out more about HON's ethics, go to www.hon.ch. Discuss what you learn on the internet with your physician. Doctors are used to patients inquiring about information learned on the internet. A good physician will comment fairly on any information you bring. Libraries. While your local public library is a good place to start researching, be sure you don't forget about all the libraries in your area. If you live near a university or medical center, these may be even better options for the type of digging you'll be doing. Often these have the most up-to-date medical books and periodicals. No matter where you choose to begin, be sure to use the library's finest resource, librarians. Getting librarians on your side can get you better information faster than the internet. Don't be afraid to ask for their help. More often than not, they'll love the research challenge. Periodicals. You'd be surprised at the wealth of information in newsletters, often put out by one or two dedicated people from a home office. These usually report local news about your illness, including support group listings and the latest goings-on in the community. Since patients often develop the material, I've found these small desktop published periodicals to carry information most pertinent to me. The other benefit of newsletters is you don't have to actively hunt down the information. It arrives in your mailbox once a month or thereabouts. Research doesn't get much easier than that. Check with your local Chronic Illness Foundation for area newsletters and information on how to subscribe. Many diseases have their own weekly, monthly, or quarterly publications, such as the Diabetic Digest. Check the internet, the library, or ask at your doctor's office for a publication that's appropriate for you. With their insightful articles from patients and physicians, these magazines can be great, especially if you're bedridden and it's difficult for you to actively go out and do your own research. Lori's Toolbox 3. A map to the internet. Where do you want to go? It's easy to get lost in the infinitely layered world of the web. To avoid information overload, it helps to have a map or a game plan of where you want to go. Are you interested in basic information on your condition? Start at a medical research site like MedM at www.medem.com. This site gets its information from the nation's leading medical societies and offers libraries, news, and learning centers. Are you looking for a place to tell your story or to hear other people's? Start at www.healingwell.com. Are you looking for objective, comprehensive, newsy coverage on your illness? Do a search on a news site like www.pbs.com, which puts together a series on chronic illness in America. Oftentimes, news outlets are a great resource since the information is non-jargony, more objective, and heavily researched. Don't know where to begin? Go to www.yahoo.com or www.google.com and type in a keyword. Here are a few good places to start, depending on your need. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. This is a searchable site that tells you everything you need to know about the HHS, a federal agency that helps protect the general public's health and, in specific, aids the elderly, the very young, the poor, and the disabled with medical and insurance issues, available at www.os.dhhs.gov. National Institutes of Health. Here you'll be able to look up medical conditions, medications, find out how you can participate in research studies, get references, look up information on the government's special health programs, and, well, the list goes on and on. Available at www.nih.gov. MedM. This site provides information from the nation's medical societies, available at www.medm.com. WebMD provides a wealth of health information and tools for managing your health from an award-winning website, which is continuously reviewed for accuracy and timeliness, available at www.webmd.com. Health Central provides a collection of websites providing trusted medical information from doctors, researchers, and expert patients, as well as news, information, video, and other multimedia content on health-related subjects, available at www.healthcentral.com. Healing Well. This easy-to-navigate site provides support, information, and resources on chronic illness, available at www.healingwell.com. The Invisible Disabilities Advocate. This homegrown site helps people understand chronic illness, available at www.invisibledisabilities.com/websites.htm. Partnering with others. Educate yourself through support groups. As you work with your medical care team and do your own research, you will run across literally hundreds of support groups for your disease. These can be a great way to get information, and they have the added benefit of helping you realize you aren't alone in this, that lots of people live with your chronic condition. I have benefited from support groups. I have made great friends, felt understood, and learned new information on kidney disease, even though I thought I had already learned all there was to know. Penny Day, who suffers from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, said she didn't really understand the disease until she joined a support group called the Emphysema Foundation for Our Right to Survive. The doctors don't really explain it, they just give you medication and that's it, Day explains. Then I just happened to come across a support group called Efforts on the internet. They are a wealth of information. Basically, everything I learned about COPD, I learned through them. I learned it's not a death sentence, and I learned how to have a better lifestyle. I don't think the medical community really understands what we are going through, and the people who are living with it obviously do. Support groups not only offer members emotional support and camaraderie, but also practical solutions and ideas for living with a disability. Mandy Gordon, for example, discovered local yoga classes for people suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome through her online support group. This information was invaluable as she had tried all other types of exercise without success. Even the most mild yoga left me exhausted, but this support group sent me a list of exercises that did work and where there are classes held, she says. You can find support groups by looking online, asking your healthcare professional or your local hospital or nonprofit organization for your disease, such as the Lupus Foundation of America if you have lupus. A support group in an exercise class is clothing. I used to go to an exercise swimming program at the YMCA for people with arthritis. Every week, a lively group of women would suit up and head to the pool. An exercise specialist from the Arthritis Foundation instructed us how to move our bodies appropriately so we would not injure our joints. Session after session, as we chatted and swam, the class naturally evolved into a support group. If the idea of an actual support group feels phony or unnatural to you, you can try joining an exercise group or some other activity-related club for people with your illness, and you may just reap the benefits without the initial awkwardness. If you can't find one, consider starting your own. Also, a support group doesn't have to be a group of people, it can be a friend. When I was in my early 20s, I checked into the hospital to receive 2 units of blood, a procedure that occurred every 6 weeks. This particular day, I was placed in a room with a girl named Gloria. Gloria had lived with kidney disease for as long as I had. We became fast friends. If I hadn't have dozed off because of the sleeping medication, we could have chatted nonstop for 6 hours. Gloria and I exchanged phone numbers and continued our friendship. We would discuss symptoms over the phone at night, talk about solutions to daily problems, and listen to each other's stories of dating. A hot topic was when, or if, you tell a date you have an illness. The priceless conversations allowed me to talk openly with someone who understood. Because I benefited so greatly from this experience, I decided to create the Renal Support Network Directory, a booklet of names and phone numbers of people with renal disease. I asked for patient volunteers to lend their names and phone numbers so others with renal disease would always have a friend to turn to. The first edition, in 1993, had more than 200 patients and family members. Today, RSN has multiple programs that help people with kidney disease. Pitfalls of support groups. Some groups can reinforce the victim role of having a chronic illness, and that's not what you want. In support groups, I've found I've met 2 types of people. Those who are searching for solutions to their problems, and those who are content to continually complain about their problems. When you visit a support group, if the majority of participants are negative and not trying to chart a new future for themselves, run for the hills. One group I joined seemed intent on only exchanging horror stories about symptoms and medical professionals. While learning about other people's symptoms can be validating, even relieving, if all the talk is negative, 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 beware. You can start to feel even worse because you are always dwelling on the pain. You can second-guess your care, and you can hold on to your anger because it resurfaces week after week. My suggestion is to always give a support group a few visits before making up your mind. But if it is persistently a downer, quit. Find another one that meets your needs.
A man too busy to take care of his health is like a mechanic too busy to take care of his tools. Spanish proverb.
Of horses and support groups. A man inherited a horse. The horse had a remarkable thoroughbred heritage, but was old and had seen better days. It had a very pronounced sway back and wheezed with every breath. By some unusual twist of fate, the new owner was able to get the tired old horse entered in the Kentucky Derby. Of course, the horse finished dead last. In fact, it barely made the first turn by the time the winning horse crossed the finish line. It came time for the Belmont Stakes, and the horse was entered in this race, too. Once again, he finished last. Next came the Preakness Stakes. You guessed it. He was entered in the race. This time, the horse barely made it out of the starting gate. A friend of the owner asked him why he kept entering the horse in the races. You know he can't win, he said. I realize that, explained the owner, but I think he benefits from the association. This is sort of like attending a support group. You're not going to experience a miracle cure, and it won't make all of your troubles go away. But you will meet people who are experiencing some of the same things you are. People who have worked together to develop coping skills and can help you learn some of these same skills. And probably best of all, you will find people who can relate to your problems, people who genuinely care. You may not win any races, but you will benefit from the association. Richard Daggett. Reprinted from the July-August 1992 Polio Survivors Newsletter with permission from the author. Don't get discouraged. When you get overwhelmed by your research, stop. However you go about your information gathering, I encourage you not to get discouraged. It's easy to become depressed after reading story after story of other people's tragic losses. It's only a matter of time before you start thinking, is this going to happen to me? When you start to get overwhelmed, stop. Get offline or get out of the library and read an uplifting book, see a funny movie, or cuddle up with your cat. Do anything that gets your mind off your health, even if it's only for a few moments. When you come across hard-to-swallow information, remind yourself of what is going right. The one thing that is truly inspiring about living with a chronic disease is how much hope is in our future. When I start to get down, I think of the thousands of people who are working behind the scenes inventing medication, treatment regimens, or preventative measures to improve our lives. The medical field advances so quickly, it is hard to keep up on the latest and greatest. We never stop learning, so hang on to hope.